Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen of the Eastern family and all Eastern friends. It's good to be with you again, doing what we most enjoy doing. That's talking about Eastern Airlines and listening to beautiful music, such as our opening Eastern theme music. Our hosts for tonight are Steve Thompson, Chuck Albright, George Chen, Cecile Intriago, John Rush, me, Neil Holland, and Jim Hart. Jim may have taken leave of the show tonight, but hopefully he'll drop in and we'll hear from Jim. First of all, we'd like to start our program, get it all started, and this is a sound that we have been using in the recent shows to start our show.
Clear.
Now that we have that big radial engine all started and fired up and ready to go, we'd like to send you a reminder, and that is you can call in to the show at area code 213-816-1611. Again, that's 213-816-1611. And you might call us on our toll-free number. We have a toll-free number for you, and that's 877-572-1861. Again, that's 877-572-1861, 1861. Once you hear the host on the show, all you have to do is press 1 if you want to put your comments into the host's attention. Then we can talk about them, and just hit the number 1 on your dial pad, and that puts you right into the live conversation. Again, let me repeat the toll-free. It's 877-572-1861. Now let's see what our hosts are up to and how they've fared since we didn't have a show last week. Let me see. Let's start off with Steve. Steve, what's happened since you've had a day off on last Monday? What's going on up there in North Carolina?
Hi, Neil. Well, things are really popping out. All the blooms are almost fading now. The dogwoods were in full bloom, and the temperature is into the almost 80-degree range, which is much too hot, and we'd like to keep this temperature down no further than north of the Florida line. I wore a sweatshirt out this morning, and it was a wrong dress code, because I was hot all day long, and it's I may have to turn the air on here in the house. At any rate, we are glad our listeners are back with us tonight, and we welcome them. And it's just a beautiful day here in the mountains of North Carolina. Neil.
Okay. Well, Chuck, a longtime host with our show, told me, I guess, a couple of weeks ago when before we canceled last Monday's show, and said that he's on a tournament, I believe, of golfers, and they're golfing in different areas, and so he may not be with us tonight, but if he does show up on our board, of course, we'll open his mic and Chuck can join us. But we also have a couple of hosts. One is in the New York area, and that's George Jen. George, how's everything out there on Long Island?
Well, actually, it's been pretty nice for the past couple of days. I think spring has finally sprung, and it's finally in the air. However, the fish are just starting to bite. It's still a little bit earlier. So that means it's definitely going to be a late fishing season this year. And send it on back to you, Neil.
Well, George, do you get to fish often in the summertime? Do you go out every chance? And as a matter of fact, I believe you told me you also author an article or you're syndicated in a national fishing magazine. Is that right?
Yes, I was for 5 years. I did a weekly column with the Fisherman magazine, which is mainly an East Coast magazine, but there are people who get it all over the country. And now, with my work on my books, I didn't have the time to continue doing it every week, so I've been just doing a lot of freelance articles. In fact, I had one in this week's magazine on striped bass fishing, and where else but right in front of my home here. I mean, it couldn't get any closer, you know?
Okay. Very good. Thanks for the report. And also, formerly, our Philadelphia host has relocated. Now he's down in the hotbed of politics area, close to Washington and Baltimore, in the Maryland area. And that's George John Ruth. John, how are things now in your new adopted area? And tell us where you're close to.
Well, yeah, it's going well. I still have a lot of boxes in the rec room to unpack, but otherwise it's nice. The weather's really nice. I'm located in Damascus, Maryland, which is basically 20 miles from Washington, D.C., 20 miles from Baltimore. So I'm close enough but far enough away. The weather here has been really nice. The trees are blooming. I took a walk yesterday in the county park, which is behind the house here. I didn't realize it was so big. We have a big, beautiful county park with a trail that goes almost 20 or 30 miles down into Germantown, Maryland. So that's the next town down the road. But it's really nice. I think I'm really going to enjoy it here.
Go ahead.
We've had a little bit of rain, but it rained buckets over, last week, and then the weekend was really nice. So we have supposed to have a little bit more rain this evening, and then I think we're going to get the weather from down south pretty soon. They're forecasting 80, 85 degrees by Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. So I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. Our next host is in the... I guess Boca area. I had the pleasure of traveling south down I-95 down toward Fort Lauderdale in the Miami area last week, and that's one of the reasons we didn't have our show. And I had the pleasure of having dinner with our next host, Cecile Entriago, and Charlie, and they took me out to a wonderful place that I always enjoy anytime I'm in the Fort Lauderdale area. And that's the Quarterdeck Grill there in Fort Lauderdale, close to the 17th Street Bridge area. Cecile, how are you and Charlie tonight?
Very great, and it was a pleasure meeting you finally. I felt like I knew you already, but it was the first time us meeting. And the weather down here is 82 degrees and low of 72, beautiful clear sky. We had some rain Saturday, but Sunday was gorgeous. And I do have to share a little fishing story. My grandson, Ethan, caught a 3-pound barracuda. And right here off the dock off of Charlie's condo, and it was really awesome to watch him. He was just so excited. Of course, he told everybody it was a 5-pound fish, so his fish stories are already starting at the age of 5.
Hey, George, can you eat barracuda?
You have to be careful about them. Certain ones, the flesh is poisonous. I don't know how you make the determination. I know if you do eat them that they're pretty good, but I tell you the truth, I'm not a big fish eater. I usually let them go when I catch them anyway, you know.
Okay.
We let him go, and my granddaughter said, Nanny, you're letting him go, and then he's in the water again. It's a barracuda. I go, you not even think about it, but the restaurant said if it's under a certain poundage, it's good eating, but over, it is poisonous, so we didn't take a chance. We threw him right back in the water.
There you go.
Okay.
You know, Neil, one thing I wanted to discuss just briefly. You know, I think I had spoken to you before I went, but I went fishing down in Panama a few weeks ago. But, I mean, the fishing was great. It was a fantastic time. I've done a story on it already, which will appear in December. But the thing that I could not get over, and I don't know how many of you have been there, was the Miami International Airport. It has changed so much since Eastern flew in and out of there. In fact, it's changed a lot since I flew out, in and out of there with U.S. Airways, that it boggled my mind. The American terminal is the old Eastern terminal, and they have a monorail and shops and restaurants all over the place there. It's unbelievable.
Wow. Yeah, I would imagine we wouldn't recognize it if we went into the terminal area. I guess we could probably identify it. Flying and landing on the east-west runways,
even that, if my memory serves me correctly, it used to be 9 left and 9 right. Well,
yeah.
I guess the compass has shifted a little bit because now it's 8 left and 8 right, no more runway 9.
Wow. Oh, my golly. Man. Huh. Well, we probably wind up at Opa-locka, landing at Opa-locka.
There you go. Or Fort Lauderdale, the other.
Well, finally it comes to me, and I'm here in Ponte Vedra, Florida. A lot of people can't even pronounce the name Ponte Vedra. I hear it pronounced so many different ways. But we're halfway between Jacksonville and St. Augustine. And by the way, St. Augustine Airport just started commercial scheduled airline service. And Frontier Airline is now serving St. Augustine up to the, I think it's the New York area. New Jersey, it's New Jersey, Trenton, New Jersey, as a matter of fact. So St. Augustine nonstop to Trenton, New Jersey, and coming back. They do that three times a week, hoping to add more flights as the passenger requirements dictate to more service and to different cities. So hope St. Augustine has had a couple of airlines that have come into the airport there. And it's, what, about 39 miles south of Jacksonville. Jacksonville has all the service. But and really, it's about, I guess, maybe halfway between Jacksonville and Daytona Beach. And Daytona Beach has got a lot of service. So, but we're rooting for St. Augustine because Ponte Vedra is halfway in between. And we have the famous Players' Championship coming up next weekend. So next Thursday. This Thursday, we start the Players' Championship TPC, and it's played at the course there that it used to be played on the Sawgrass, the old Sawgrass court course, but now it's got its own field, or course rather, and beautiful facilities, and all the leading golfers, of course, will be in that tournament. One of the highest purses, I guess you'd call it purses or stakes or whatever, however they pay their winners. But I'm not much of a golfer. Chuck could tell us all about that. The weather here is great. It's warm. It's almost 90 degrees today. And I sure kind of already missed the cool air. But before we go into our little program and tell you about things that passengers should know and afraid to ask, here's an ad that Eastern had, and let's see if our listeners remember this Eastern ad and how well it went over and was received. And let's see if you can remember this and the program, and because it did, it was very successful.
At last, one airline has done something unique for America's senior citizens.
For only $999 each, we can travel anywhere Eastern flies in the U.S. for a year. So we're going to visit our niece in Boston, our kids in L.A., and dear old mom in Florida.
If you're 65, you qualify. You can even get a passport for a companion who travels with you regardless of age. Call Eastern or your travel agent for details.
Eastern Get Up and Go Passport. It was worth waiting for.
Eastern, America's favorite way to fly.
Well, I finally hit 65. I wonder if I can get the new Eastern to give me a pass like that. It sure was nice back in those days. Do you remember that?
I remember it well. Get up
that is one of the, that was one of the best programs that they ever put together, and I have people to this day remembering that program that took advantage of it.
Yeah, it really was a great great program.
Did a lot of business with that.
Yeah. You know, recently I came upon an article that was written by Robert Firpo Capello. I guess I'm pronouncing his name wrong, I'm sure. But it's dated April 23rd, which was a little over a week ago. And it was about the airline's dirtiest secrets, is what he called the airline's dirtiest secrets. And I thought we might go over them with our own comments about these and other secrets we can share with our listeners tonight. Steve, start us out with this.
Yes, we know the questions that pop up into your head when you fly. Is the cabin air full of germs? Is the water safe to drink? How are the pets treated in the hold? There are lots of misinformation out there, and we're cutting through the clutter here to deliver the good, the bad, and the downright gross. I recently had a fun segment on morning TV here in New York about the airline's dirtiest secrets. Lately, there's been a lot of idle speculation in the blogosphere about the cleanliness of airplanes, the flight worthiness of the equipment, and the abilities of the crew. Here at Budget Travel, we regularly interview pilots, flight attendants, and other travel professionals, sometimes on condition of anonymity, and we do our best to debunk the junk and deliver the truth. That said, the truth sometimes hurts. Inspired by my hosts at PX11 Morning News, I'm not only delivering the airline's dirty secrets, but also rating them on a scary scale of 1 to 5. Any comments?
I'm just not certain we ought to go through the rest of these dirty secrets that Arthur has that we're about to give our listeners. But one of the questions is, are pets stored in an unheated and unpressurized hold in the cargo area? And his comment was, I hate to get all Mr. Scott about this, but this legend absolutely defies the laws of physics. At 30,000 feet, that would mean temperatures below zero and not enough oxygen. The truth is, pets are kept warm and safe in the hold. However, airline travel can be harrowing for pets. The runway is so noisy during loading and unloading that the workers wear headphones. No such luck for Fido and Fluffy. Oh, and flying with a little dog in your lap or asking repeatedly about the safety of your pet in the hold really irritates overworked, underpaid flight attendants. If you're a pet lover or even just a decent human being, that rates a 5 on the scary scale. But before you consider sedating your pet, the way you might take, say, an Ambien before takeoff, get your vet's best advice for dealing with airplane travel. You know, my son and his two cats travel over to Europe a couple of times, and I thought that if I were one of my son's two cats or both cats, I think I would mutiny that family, because every time they moved somewhere over to Finland, it's where his wife's from, and then down to Spain, and then over to Costa Rica, along went those pets. So my son did a pretty careful study about how to handle pets, and he got a lot of the information off of the internet. So if anyone has a pet that wants to put it on the airplane, I'd suggest highly that you go to the internet and search the browser and search for, you know, how pets are handled. And I know unloading some cargo areas from time to time, I think, Steve, I'm sure it's happened to you, John, probably you too, and George, that animals have escaped the whole area and took off across the airport. I'm sure some of them were never found again. But had any of you had that experience?
Well,
oh yeah,
I recall a story. You might remember it, Neil, down in New Orleans, where it was a 727 landed there, and the ramp workers opened up the cargo hold, and there was a dog in there, and but the poor dog was dead. So the cargo handlers, they didn't know what to do. They thought, you know, the dog died during the flight. Well, one of them had a bunch of puppies at home that looked just like the dog that was in the cargo compartment. So he ran home, got one of the puppies, put it on a conveyor belt and delivered it to whoever was waiting for the dog, which was great, except for the fact that the dog was being shipped down there to be buried, and it was already dead when it got on the flight. So, I mean, that was kind of the opposite of what we're talking about here, you know.
Funny story.
That's a true story, very true.
Oh my golly. That's kind of like the person that was in a casket on Eastern's crash here in Jacksonville area. Do you guys remember that? It was in a Constellation, and it crashed just south of Jacksonville Airport, the old Imeson Field. And they counted it as one of the passengers because the airplane did catch on fire, and they found this body in the I guess it had broken loose from the casket of the container the body was in. And so they just counted it along with the rest of the passengers, and they tried and tried to figure out just how they got an extra passenger on board.
But, well, wasn't there also a case in Miami where someone had shipped one or two dogs down there, and when the plane got there, the dogs had unfortunately died. And if I remember correctly, the guy somehow grabbed an axe and started chopping up the plane with it. And he was so upset about the dogs dying. But I don't think Eastern ever pressed charges against him because he was really distraught about it. I don't know if any of you remember that story.
I do.
I don't remember it.
I remember the story.
Well, Cecile now is going to tell us about the airplane drinking water problem. Cecile, is there a problem with drinking airplane water?
Sorry, maybe not. Tests show that airplane water is sometimes full of bacteria that could sicken you, and this has been confirmed in tests by the Environmental Protection Agency and the Wall Street Journal. That goes for onboard coffee and tea as well. Water is better than it is used to be thanks to airline mandated tests, so the water is better now. But the big tanks that hold water on a plane are a breeding ground for gunk, and you don't want it in your cup. The EPA even warns people with at-risk immune systems, including children and adults over 50, to avoid airplane water. Buy a bottle, scary scale. Wow, I would say I would bring my own bottle of water.
I think most people do now. A lot of folks do. And
yes,
I don't know.
They don't get any on the planes anymore.
Can you order along with your sodas? I haven't been on an airplane in about 3 or 4 years, but you know, when you order a soda, can't you get a bottle of water from the flight attendant as they go down the aisle?
Yes.
You know, I think, but they charge you $2 or something like that. They don't give it to you for free like they used to anymore. So you better off bringing your own bottle of water, guys.
Yeah. Okay. George, do airplanes jettison their toilet waste into the air?
Well, I don't know who started this myth. Maybe it was some young child from the fourth grade, but the answer is no. Aircraft do not jettison toilets into midair, ever, ever, ever. Well, at least not intentionally. A California man once had a chunk of frozen airplane waste, which, by the way, is colored blue because of the chemical that the airlines use to treat the waste, come through his sailboat. On a scary scale of 1 to 5, I've got to give the sailboat guy a true 5. And when I was a kid, I grew up probably 3 miles from the end of runway 22 left at JFK, and right on the approach for that runway. And a neighbor about a quarter of a mile away, as apparently, you know, if you recall, they had a heater that was when the water from the sink went down, the heater heated it so that it didn't form any ice and just dissipated into the air. Now, I'm not talking about the toilet bowl contents. I'm talking about the sink. And but apparently this aircraft, the heater was malfunctioning, and as the airplane got lower and was about to land at Kennedy, there was apparently a huge ball of ice that had formed around the drain for the sink, and it fell, and it went right through the roof of this guy's house. And that is a true story. I swear by it.
Okay.
Neil, I have a story about blue water. When the airline was having some union problems and we all had to pitch in and do everything, I was in charge of one of my tasks was to put the hose that connects with the bathroom, and you had to be careful because if you didn't do it right, the water would come out. Well, obviously, I wasn't doing it right, and the blue water came out. And I really value their job that they did every day and wouldn't want to do it again. But that was quite an experience.
Oh.
It definitely is blue water, by the way.
Well, I hate to burst the bubble here. I don't know how many of you guys folks have done a pre-flight inspection on a Boeing 727. In the older planes that we had, there was an old Boeing blender in the tail. It was a macerator. And that thing, back in the day, well, you know, before they passed legislation to contain the waste, used to macerate the waste from the bathrooms and spray it into the slipstream as the airplane flew overhead. So it did exist at one time.
Ah.
But if you walk down behind the back end of 727, just forward of the where the engine inlet is, there's a if you look up, there's a hole there, and there's a bunch of blades in the hole, and that was a macerator that used to chop up everything from the bathroom and just let it go into the slipstream. But like I said, back in the early 70s, they passed legislation that they had to install holding tanks on the airplanes, but they did have those.
Okay. Well, how about trains? You reckon they have any problems dumping theirs on the tracks?
I imagine at one time they did.
and the buses dropping theirs, the Greyhounds on the highways, on the interstate highways.
I was wondering
How about cruise ships that have 5,000 people on board? Where in the world do they contain that waste?
Holding tanks.
The ocean, I would imagine.
Well, some of the old boats that were out there had, it would shoot it right out the back or the side of the boat when you went to the bathroom.
Oh, boy. Huh. Well, John, how about mood lighting? Is that
a
problem
anymore? We'll get onto a better subject here.
There you go.
Why do the planes lights dim before landing? Dim light prepares your eyes for seeing outside in the event of emergency evacuation. Similarly, you are asked to open your window shades before landing so that the crew can see outside in the event of an accident. On a scary scale of 1 to 5, I'm going to give this a 1 because once you understand the reason for it, it seems kind of comforting. And I am the only one?
No, I think that's it's very true. I wonder why people pull the shades down at night. I often wondered about that. And but now the new Boeings.
Yeah. I used to like looking out the window.
I know it, especially at the strobe lights at the tips of the wings at nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
But the new airplanes, the Boeing Dreamliner, and I don't know about I think it's on the Dreamliner only. They have controls for the windows, and you can set the coloration and, I guess, the mood that you want to be in, even if it's high noon and the sun is brilliantly shining. You can just kind of subdue the light down to a gentle shade and rest, from what I understand about that Dreamliner airplane.
Wow.
Well, Chuck was going to ask us about the cabin air is making me sick, right? Well, people complain about the cabin air, but wrong. Airplane cabin air is filtered and often test cleaner than hospital air. Well, I wouldn't think hospital air is too clean with all the germs that's in hospitals. But, however, just about everything else on board should be considered a mile-high Petri dish. In fact, your tray table may have been used to change a baby. Yeah, that's right. E. coli bacteria are regularly found on airplane tray tables. What can you do about that? Travel with sanitizing wipes to clean off surfaces you or your loved ones may touch during the flight, and to clean your hands. On a scary scale, the cabin air gets a zero, and the tray table gets maybe a number two. Oh, I'm sorry about that. No pun intended. But, I'm sure there's plenty of places that you can find germs on an airplane. And at one time, I remember back in the prop days, Steve, back me up on this. You're old enough to remember this, that Eastern had a little head cloths or napkins that were snapped on, I believe, the best I can recall, on the Convairs and the Martins. And they changed those during the change of flights because they didn't want people to rest their head against someone else's that had been there and perhaps left a few lice or two. You recall that?
Yes, I do recall that. I sure do. I remember that.
Now,
yes.
Have you seen any of those little head towels, or what do they call them? Oh, there was a napkin of some sort. I know there's a name for it. I just can't find that name in my mind.
Was it a headscarf or something?
You mean the little napkins that they used to put in the oven and hand them out to you that were hot?
Yeah, well, they did that too, but no, this was not heated. This was just a napkin that they put. As a matter of fact, Greyhound Bus and some of the bus systems used to do that because people were so concerned about resting their head back to take a nap, and someone else had been there before them, and worrying about head lice and the other little creepy crawlers that they might inherit during that flight. So we did have those little napkins that they did change from time to time, and then all of a sudden they just kind of disappeared. And I don't know what's protecting our heads now from someone that might have a head full of lice.
How did we survive all those years?
I don't know.
We become immune to all the bacteria. I have a question. Did you all hear about that MERS that is in Indiana, I guess? And they are now contacting the persons that traveled from London to New York, originated in Saudi Arabia, and he has MERS. But that disease that's non-curable. Did you all hear about that?
He was a doctor. As I recall, he was a doctor that was treating that disease in some Arabic country.
I think
was
MERS
Nigeria?
Is what? Middle Eastern something.
Right. Yeah. Did the passengers get it, though, in the air, or they had to be touched? Why are they contacting all the people?
I don't know that.
From London to whatever. So, anyway, so I just heard about that.
Apparently, it's a communicable disease, and it can be spread from one person to another, maybe by just touching surfaces.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to travel with gear then. What's those? We're going to travel with travel suits. You know? Well, oh, boy.
Well, maybe those people in the Middle East that wear burkas are not that crazy after all. I shouldn't say that, but you know, your body is well protected if you're in a burka.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
No, I'm talking about like a space suit. We're gonna have to travel in a
space
suit.
Yeah. Well, they kind of look
totally
like space
protected.
Suits. Too.
Yeah, it is.
Well, Steve,
right.
Tell me how I can be sure my pilot knows what he or she is doing, Steve.
Well, we have talked about all of these things that are a threat to the traveler, like a E. coli on the fold-down table. But the most important thing is you should ask, how can I be sure my pilot knows what he or she is doing? How experienced is your pilot? And how worried should you be about that? Well, you may be flying one of the big carriers in name, but here in the U.S., you may actually be in the hands of a subcontracted regional airline crew. Oh, and your pilot may make less in a year than a cab driver. Yep. These regional airlines have grown so fast in recent decades that requirements for pilot training went down to accommodate the demand. If you were having, say, brain surgery, would you want the doctor with more operations under his belt or the guy getting paid by the hour? Well, that said, I've never had a bad experience due to pilot error, and we travelers often completely misjudge pilot actions, like a bumpy landing, for instance, or flying through turbulence, or no indication of a pilot's experience or competency. They just happened. But how would you rate the issue of pilot's experience on a scary scale, a 4 or a 5?
In this country, my answer would be, I would say that our airline pilots, especially the major carriers, are well qualified. Now, I would question the competency and the training skills and the flying skills of some companies like Asiana that landed well short of the runway in San Francisco. Didn't know how to fly the airplane manually when it came off autopilot. And so, you know, some of these airlines now are so used to training completely automatic without any backup training about how to fly the airplane manually, and we've talked about it in past shows.
Well, I am doing, for your information, a presentation in June to the Aviation ABA here in New York, and the subject matter, I was requested to do it, by the way, the subject matter is pilot training and automation addiction, and it's exactly about that particular problem that Neil just spoke about, and it's pretty scary, I'll tell you that. It's especially as the older, more experienced pilots are retiring, some of the younger pilots that are coming up right now, those are the only things that they've ever known. So, I mean, probably the largest example of it was the case that you cited, Neil, about Asiana, and the other one was the Air France crash in the Atlantic Ocean on the way to Paris. Yeah. I mean, would an experienced pilot have done those things? I don't know. It's, I mean, you never say never, but it would be hard for me to imagine that anyone with any basic knowledge of fly-by-hand knowledge would have been susceptible to the gross errors that were made in both of those cases.
And you know, George, you can't say that it's just foreign carriers, because we had one of our own regional carriers up north that had icing problems, and we recall what happened there, and all the passengers and the crew was killed on that flight.
Right.
It's a lack of common sense.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Is it lack of common sense, or is it lack of basic knowledge of flying characteristics of an aircraft?
Yeah, well, I mean, they came up through, you know, a general aviation, I'm sure they'd be aware of these things, but problem is nowadays everything's done with computers, and you don't know where the person's gotten their, you know, obviously they've had to fly and demonstrate their skills, but a lot of them just, you know, use computers to fly as simulators, and they've never been out in the real world in hard IFR conditions like icing or thunderstorms or anything like that. You know, that's something you can't reproduce in a simulator.
And Steve, I'm sure you've talked to Joy, your daughter, about her military training, but that's been many years ago. But I'm sure they did the stick and rudder routine as far as basic training. Was not all electronic when she went through flight school.
No, it wasn't. And then she grew up with having her father as one of her instructors.
Right. Yeah.
And insisting that she learn to fly in a tail dragger. So that's where she got her start. So not every pilot is lucky enough to have Steve Thompson as one of their instructors.
Well, very good. I did some instructing myself, but no one in my family would get in the airplane for me to instruct because they thought I would scream and yell at them the whole time. But my son did finally learn to fly on his own after he graduated from Georgia Tech. He went to California and worked out there. Of course, he was a Marine officer, and when he retired, not retired, when he finished his service there, he decided that, by golly, I think I would like to fly. And I, as Steve knows, I own several airplanes in the Atlanta and Gainesville area. And I could have taught him all that time, but his eyes were so bad, I didn't think he stood a chance. And I certainly didn't encourage him to get into aviation, so he went the engineering route. He finally became a pilot and enjoyed it for a while, and he's recently... left the service of the little airline that he was flying with out there. Cecile, how about those pillows and blankets? Now, we've talked a little bit about that, and headphones. Do you think they are cleaned or changed after every flight? Cecile? I don't know whether she's trying to talk with us or not, but I think she's had some problems with her.
Well, I see.
She dropped off the line there. Cecile, do you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay.
For some reason or other, you dropped off the line. But tell us about those pillows and blankets that are changed after every flight, right?
Right. Cue Aerosmith and dream on. Flight crews are busy. Budgets are tight, and you've probably witnessed the onboard scramble that occurs between flights. And if your blanket is nearby, neatly folded, and your headphones are in the plastic bag, congrats. That's about the best you can hope for these days. On our scary scale, I guess I'm going to give it a 3 or a 4.
Yeah. Well, I certainly want to wear a headset that was that I had to open the little plastic envelope that they were in instead of seeing that someone else may have worn the headset. I don't even know whether they have the little earbuds now that they put over the head, the earpiece. Anyone recently been flying?
Well, I know American has flight headsets that you can buy in flight for a couple of dollars, and you can take them with you. But they only work in the sound system on the airplane. The plugs there, but I think that those are disposable. But I don't know about the other ones. I know the Eastern used to have ones that, you know, you could, they were just basically like a
tubes,
a normal headset, you know, with a coiled cord on them, that they were reused all the time.
Yeah. Well,
the earplugs in plastics, and then you put them on the actual headset, but the earplugs are always in plastic, so they're all brand new, typically.
Gee whiz, I got to go out and take an airline flight and see what they're doing these days.
I think you're in for a big surprise, Neil.
Who'd you go
it's
down to
Panama
with?
It's not worth the effort, Neil.
Yeah. George, who did you fly with down to Panama?
I flew on American. Actually, you know, since U.S. Air merged or bought American, I could get passes on American now. But I purchased the ticket because I didn't want to miss out, go standby, and perhaps miss out on a day or two of fishing, you know.
Well, you were an airline pilot, George, and do you remember that we were served separate meals, or were we served separate meals?
Well, I recall that at Eastern, the rule was that we both weren't supposed to eat our crew meals together at the same time, if you recall that. This way, if one guy keeled over, then the other guy wouldn't eat the crew meal. I don't know if that's still the case, because a lot of the airlines in their contracts now, they've done away with crew meals. Yeah, a lot of them don't have them anymore, except in very, very, very extenuating circumstances where you've been on duty for a long time and not at an airport, you know.
Oh.
I mean, that is really a pretty good idea, of course, and that you brought up. I wish I could tell you that it's strictly enforced. But the reality is that the crew eats whatever they want, whenever they can get it. I mean, you probably remember the pilots at Eastern sometimes taking a little stroll back to the galley and coming back with some goodies from the galley. But today, some people bring their own food. Others eat whatever is given them out of the galley. And on some flights, the captain and the co-pilot, you know, they are served separate meals. But on others, you know, not too often. So from what I've seen, the few times when you do get a crew meal, I've never heard about a poison pilot wreaking havoc in the sky. So I'd give this maybe a 1.5 to 2 on the fright scale.
Okay. Well, I never got a bad meal, I don't think, especially flying out of Mexico City back to Atlanta. Oh, I remember those days, and those meals that we got out of Mexico City were fantastic.
Hey, you know what? They really built up our immune systems, if nothing else.
And then those famous dinner flights, famous meal flights that we had back in the 70s when Floyd Hall initiated that, and he had the best restaurants in the areas that we flew into to cater those flights. And you remember the china and the silver that we used and the crystal and so forth. Matter of fact, I got a few pieces of that I have in my own collection and remembering those days when we had those famous meal flights. And, boy, were they good.
Wow.
Yeah, Eastern had some good food in general.
Yeah, I think we probably had, and you know, a good friend of mine was a station manager here with Delta Airlines in Jacksonville, and we see each other every Thursday when I go over for Panera Bread in the morning, and he talks about the catering that Delta has, which was with Dobbs House, and then of course Eastern's was through Marriott. And I think Marriott was a great caterer. We had them for many, many, many years. And so that was... John, is it true that oxygen masks have only a few minutes of air in them?
Well, yes, but it's not as bad as it sounds. Airplanes are pressurized mostly because the air at 30,000 feet does not hold enough oxygen. In the very rare event of depressurization, the oxygen masks descend, and though it may be frightening, passengers use them for a few minutes while the pilot quickly gets the airplane down to around 10,000 feet, where oxygen levels are comparable to a mountain summit. On a scary scale, this makes me feel like a little safer, and I give it a 1. Though if you've ever been on a plane that has descended from 30,000 to 10,000 in a matter of minutes, it's not a theme park ride in the world that you ever want to scare, you know, go on again. But, you know, all you need to do is pull the spoilers out and you can dump 20,000 feet in no time. But, yeah, on the, I remember on the MDA or the RDC-9s, we had the bottled oxygen, which was, you know, in a canister above each seat. And I think they were good for maybe 5 or 10 minutes at best. But by that time, you could get the airplane down to, you know, a breathable altitude, whereas I think the other airplanes we had tanks that we had. I think on the 727, the tanks were down below in bin 2 or 3. I forget which one it was. But and in the most part, that stuff is fodder for the movies, not for real life.
Well, I just remember just a couple of weeks ago, we had a little teenager that took off out of California and went to Honolulu and in the wheel well. So can you tell me how that was possible, that he had enough oxygen? Is there enough trapped oxygen for a young man like that? He must have been born in La Paz at 14,000 feet and was used to...
I don't know how he lived.
Yeah, how did he live through it?
I don't know how he ever lived through it, because you go up to 30,000 feet, you got 20 seconds of useful consciousness, and then temperature's 50 below zero. Hello? Yeah.
Well, I have a real-life scary story about that, if you'd like to hear it.
Yes.
Yeah, there,
go for it.
I believe it was 4 or 5 years ago, there was a Cypriot airliner that took off. I think it was from Cyprus going to Frankfurt or someplace else. I'm not certain of the destination. And when the aircraft, it was a 737, when the aircraft got to 10,000 feet, the altitude warning horn went off. And the captain was German and the co-pilot was Greek. So there's obviously a little bit of communication problems. And on the 737, the overspeed warning and the altitude warning horn were both the same. So the captain figured, oh, it's the overspeed warning is malfunctioning, and he got out of his seat to pull the circuit breaker, and he passed out. And then the co-pilot passed out. In the meantime, they had the aircraft, they had already programmed the FMC and had the airplane on autopilot, so the plane just kept climbing. And, of course, at 14,000 feet, all the passenger oxygen masks came down. The flight attendants, because they had the barricaded cockpit door, they couldn't get into the cockpit. So the aircraft flew up to, I think it was 31,000 feet. Don't hold me to the exact altitude. I think that was it. And flew for over 2 hours till it got to the final programmed waypoint that was in the FMC, went into a holding pattern, and flew around until the aircraft ran out of fuel and it crashed. Unfortunately, everyone was killed. I think that was in maybe 2008, but very, very sad. They had worked on the outflow valves, the maintenance people, the night before, and they had blocked them off and forgotten to remove or neglected to remove the blocks from the outflow valves, so the airplane never pressurized. But you never, there wasn't much publicity around here for that particular crash, but I think if you Google it, you could probably find it.
I had one rapid decompression, and that was over Tallahassee going to Atlanta. And the engineer says, "Captain, we're losing pressure." And I recall that my command was, "Can you manually control it?" And he said, "No, sir." And I said, "Oxygen on 100%. And, boy, you remember the checklist for rapid pressurization. And down we came. We came all the way down. I think we went on down to 14,000 or 10,000 feet. But it was an outflow valve problem. And in that area of the airplane, it was a 727, in that area of the airplane, there was a container, breakage in the cargo container, and some of the contents in the cargo compartment trapped the outflow valve somehow. I can't recall now because that was many years ago, but that was a result that it blocked the outflow valve and you couldn't pressurize the air over the airplane. The airplane was pressurized, but at any rate, that was that my first rapid decompressurization. I meant to play this little thing that I found, and when we were talking about catering and that type of thing, it would have gone real well with that little discussion. But I'm going to play it anyhow. I think it's pretty cute. So listen to
Neil, here. Can I ask a quick question on depressurization? How long does it take as a passenger? How long do I have to be there from 30,000 to 10,000? How long does it take the plane to get to 10,000? How many minutes?
That's a good question. You go down at the maximum rate of descent. So you just put the nose down. You put the gear down. The speed brakes are fully deployed. And you're just putting every bit of drag you can put on that airplane to descend at as fast a rate of descent that you can. And whatever the maximum, usually you're at the maximum end of the vertical descent peg on the vertical speed indicator. And whatever that is, I don't know, and how many feet per minute you're coming down. But Steve, do you remember, George or John?
No, I don't. And I'd say far in excess of 5,000 feet a minute.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking more of a 6,000, somewhere around there, yeah.
Right.
I was wondering what prayer I should pray. How long do I have to pray?
You probably have time for like 2 hour fathers and 2 Hail Marys.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
All right. But not a full rosary.
Yeah, not a full rosary.
All right, so 5,000 for, okay, that's
here, listen to this.
Today we salute you, Mr. Airline Meal Chef. Nothing relaxes a diner like a pleasant discussion of safety procedures should the restaurant suddenly fall out of the sky.
Oh, no!
Chicken or beef? Chicken or beef? Chicken, we're out. Here's the beef.
Still tastes like chicken.
Who ordered the heart-healthy meal? Probably not the guy who ordered the seatbelt extender. So crack open an ice-cold Bud Light, O Sultan of the Salisbury. Even though we're crammed in coach, our meals are first class. Bud Light Beer, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri.
Budweiser, please bring back those commercials. They were hilarious.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Where'd you get that one? That was great.
Oh, that was a great one. They did one on every profession and everybody, I believe. Before we sign off, I've got an interesting book to make a report on. It was in our paper here locally yesterday, Sunday. And it was a story about, there were actually three stories about aviation, and I'm just going to tell you about two of them. With his patented free-flowing delivery, Winston Groom's Aviator, that's the name of the book, Aviators, reads like a novel as he takes us on Doolittle's famous bombing raid on Japan. Rickenbacker's 3 weeks lost on a small raft in the South Pacific. And Lindbergh's escapades, first as an anti-war holdout and then as a 42-year-old fighter pilot on and around war-torn New Guinea. If Groom's effort whets your appetite for more detail, a brand new biography of Rickenbacker hits the stores next week. In Enduring Courage, ace pilot Eddie Rickenbacker and the Dawn of the Age of Speed, historian and former executive editor of American Heritage magazine, John F. Ross, gives a detailed look at the hardscrabble early years of the flying ace and his meteoric rise in auto racing before the war and in aviation afterward. Ross captures the essence of all these men in his introduction about Rickenbacker. Ultimately, his story boils down to courage, not the kind of raw courage that comes in a blinding rush to charge a machine gun nest, but one that is trained to purpose and get stronger, wiser, and more effective with experience. This courage, enduring courage, doesn't just happen, but must be worked for and earned. George Washington had it. So did Ulysses S. Grant and Teddy Roosevelt. No other single trait has so forcefully shaped the American nation. So watch for the Aviators and book by John F. Ross, which is called Enduring Courage, about ace pilot Eddie Rickenbacker and the dawn of the age of speed. I've tried to get in touch with John Ross, but it's very difficult to find these very popular authors that write these books. As a matter of fact, I did look up his Wikipedia background, and he was associated with the National Space and Aero Museum in Washington, D.C., so and he was the executive editor of American Heritage magazine. So that ought to be an interesting read. So look for that on the newsstands. And I still hope to get in touch with him and see if we can ask him to come on our radio show and we ask him questions about that. So many stories have been written about Eddie Rickenbacker. And I had the pleasure of, and John, I think, Steve, I think you did, and not certain about you, George, whether Eddie Rickenbacker was still alive, but I remember he passed away in the 70s.
Yes, I remember him, and I met him several times.
He wasn't at Eastern when I was there, but of course I heard of him, and I was there in the 70s.
Well, a lot of people remember Eastern Airlines, and they remember Captain Eddie Rickenbacker. Well, I hear the sound clip of Good Night, Good Night, which is our sign-off music, and glad we could get together again tonight, folks. To our hundreds of listeners around the world, we hope we can do it again next Monday at the same time, same place on your internet dial. Sign-off bumper music tells me that we are about out of time for this week's show. And as you know, all of our radio shows go by episode numbers. And we are about to put our 163rd broadcast into the radio archives, where you may listen again to this episode or any of the other episodes during the past 3-plus years we have been broadcasting. Tell your friends about the show. More importantly, get involved with the rest of our hosts by participating in these broadcasts. You're welcome to participate live and on the air each Monday. We're proud of the fact this show is the only airline company radio show of its kind. It's part of the way we are keeping the memory of Eastern alive. We consider ourselves to be the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. Well, that's all for tonight, and from all of your hosts, tonight we say good night, Eastern family and friends.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.